cricket, lovely cricket. Cricket lick the ball before it reach the ring. Welcome along to 98 Not Out. Every Thursday between 6 and 7pm. Reach the cricket. Phoenix FM's regular cricket magazine show. Wish much. With news, views, interviews, and a bit of music thrown in as well. Busy show tonight. First of all, I've got to say hi to everyone that I bumped into at Chelmsford last weekend, watching Essex playing Kent. Very good game of cricket, and good to see all the regulars down there, including Dan Hagger, Richard Clark, the Grumbler, Debbie Knight, who I've not seen for ages, and of course Don Topley up in the commentary box, and all the Essex staff as well. And special mention to the ice cream man, who made me a rather spectacular 99. First one of the year. So on tonight's show, we'll be looking back at the results from the second round of the county championship. We're looking at the effect so far of the Kookaburra ball, which has been used in these games. I'm joined by writer and a journalist, Mel Farrell. Just arrived from Australia. She's going to be telling us what she thinks of what she's seen so far. All the other usual stuff as well. Got to lick the ball before it reach the wicket. Some big news from the world of women's cricket. There are the Wisden Annual Awards have been announced this week. Lots to get through. And of course, you are listening to Phoenix FM at 98 on the FM dial in the central Essex area. Via the internet, phoenixfm.com. Or shout at your smart speaker to play Phoenix FM. And don't forget to go to the Phoenix FM website for details of this show and all the others. And make sure you subscribe to the Phoenix FM newsletter. It's free. And it gives you all the details on what's going on at the station. You could even see pictures of what all the presenters look like. You can take from me, some are doing it better than others. Alright, let's get going. And as always, we'll start off with it's cricket birthdays of the week. And starting off, Umar Gull is 40, as is JP Duminy. Craig McDermott, 59. Carl Kurtzer, another one, hitting 40. TMS favourite Dan Norcross, friend of the show as well, 55, Daniel. Lord Archer, Geoffrey Archer himself, 84. Manoj Prabhakar, 61. John Bracewell, 66. Essex legend James Foster, 44. Darren Powell, 46. George Gupp, 27. Mattia Muralitharan, 52. Brilliant England bowler Norman Cowans of England and the Middlesex, 63. Ryan Pringle, 32. KL Rahul, 32. Bill Simmons, 61. Matt Salisbury, 31. Jason Gillespie, 49. Dickie Bird, 91. Paul Rifle, 58. Scott Berthwick, 34. Naomi Stallenberg, 30. Tim Light, 44. Graham Pollock, 67. And also two listeners, Elaine Tate, who's 56. Clive Purdy, who I know, but I don't know how old he is. Graham Pryke, one of the legendary members of the Essex staff, 62. Len Tate, 78. And Dan Hagger.
You kept that quiet, old son. It is your birthday today. You're 41. You don't look it. Happy birthday to everyone on that list. And remember, if you want me to add you in, then just send me an email, radio@phoenixfm.com. Title your mail 19 about birthdays. And just tell me whose birthday it is, how old they're going to be. And if you want, just tell me a little bit about them. I will add them to the birthdays of the week.
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM.
Now, I'll start off the show with what is now becoming, with depressing irregularity, an announcement of the loss of a great name from the cricketing world. And this week, it was Derek Underwood, one of England and Kent's greatest ever bowlers, has sadly died at the age of 78. Slow left armer Underwood took 297 wickets in 86 test matches between 1966 and 1982, the most by any England spinner. He claimed 2,465 wickets in 676 first-class matches overall, representing only Kent, the country of his birth, in a stellar 24-year domestic career. You don't see much of that anymore. Underwood was also appointed an MBE in 1981, and he was also president of MCC in 2009. He took 32 wickets in 26 one-day internationals and would have represented England more, but for joining World Series cricket in 1977 and then the Rebel Tour of South Africa in 81-82. Nicknamed Deadly, Underwood was one of the 55 inaugural members inducted into the ICC Hall of Fame when it launched in 2009. Kent Cricket's chairman, Simon Phillips, said the club is in mourning following the passing of one of its greatest ever players. ECB chairman Richard Thompson said, "It's always a sad day when a great of the English game passes away. Derek Underwood will be remembered as one of the finest spin bowlers the country has ever produced, and his remarkable record is testament to his enduring skills. Our thoughts are with Derek's friends and family, everyone at Kent, and everyone who knew and loved him." And I will add to that sentiment is I met Derek a few times and actually remember watching him play for England in the early 80s, and absolute legend of the game. It's another sad loss. This isn't a good year for losing people from the world of cricket. Yes, rest in peace, Derek Underwood.
This is Phoenix 98 FM.
Okay, I'm going to play some music now, if I can find it. What have I done with it? Here it is. I was just mooching around the other day and the radio was on in the background. I wasn't paying any particular attention. And then this came on and my ears all of a sudden pricked up about halfway through, because I realised that this had been used in a very famous TV show in the 70s and 80s, so this is only going to appeal to a certain amount of people out there. I will save until the end of the programme to tell you what TV show that was. But if you want, you can message me via social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, all the rest of it. And just try and tell me if you can remember what TV show this was. You have to stick with it for a little bit. There are no clues just yet. If you get the answer, let me know.
I'm
grounds. Did you get it? I will reveal the answer at the end of the show. And I'm, well, you'd probably have to be a certain age, but that chunks of that song were used as a theme tune to a very, very popular show that was broadcast every week back in the day. If you know, message me via social media. No prizes for this, just a bit of fun. But if you know, let me know.
With the English season rapidly approaching, it must mean one thing: the arrival of the April edition of the Cricketer magazine, a bumper 116-page special with two pages on each of the 18 first-class counties and our hugely popular fixtures wall chart. We also have Vic Marks, George DeBell, David Gower, Liam Plunkett, Nick Friend, Mike Selby and Tanya Aldred. That's all in the April edition of the Cricketer magazine, out now.
Make sure you get that. It's still available. And I'm a little bird tells me that Hugh Turbeville will be at Chelmsford tomorrow. So if you want to go and see what he looks like and go and have a chat with him about the magazine, head over to Chelmsford tomorrow, where Essex are playing Lancashire. Now, we are two rounds into the 2024 County Championship, and many of you will know that there's been an experiment so far with the use of the Kookaburra cricket ball. The idea being to try and get players attuned to what it might be like in Australia when the Ashes are there, not this winter, but next winter. And I caught up with Mel Farrell, the Australian, although she's dual nationality, she always likes to remind me. She's in town for the season, has been working on some commentary up at Warwickshire. But I caught up with her to get her thoughts on whether this has been a good or a bad thing so far. Okay, my guest on this week's 98 Not Out is a good one. It's all the way from Australia. Mel Farrell has come to enjoy the windiness of the English summer. Mel, welcome along. Great to have you here.
Yeah, no, not just the wind. I'm particularly enjoying freezing cold temperatures. Love a bit of rain. basically, like sleet, I've had a bit of that as well. Great. Just love it.
Everyone's complaining. In England, we love to complain, and cricket fans really love to complain about, why are we playing cricket in April? What are we doing? You know, this needs to be stopped. And they're all blaming, of course, the 100. But the English Red Bull season starting in April is nothing new whatsoever. I saw someone put on social media a timeline of the last, I think it was 10 years, but I think you can probably go back 20 or even 30 of cricket starting this time of year. To me, it's almost a tradition that you can't wait for the season to start. The fixtures come out, you get yourself down to your local county, and yeah, you sat there in your great big parka coat, you've got your gloves on, you've got the thermals, the hot flask. That, to me, is part and parcel of cricket in April in this country.
It's a bit of a masochistic sport, isn't it? You want to suffer. It proves that you're a true hardcore fan the more you suffer, I think. And I say that. I'm up in a press box or in a commentary box, so they're usually getting some free coffee or something. So I really don't have any reason to complain. But it makes me feel more like I'm part of something special if I do complain. So I'm going to carry on whinging and moaning as much as possible.
You're turning into a whinging pom.
Well, I'm a dual citizen, remember? So that's I whip out my British passport, and that's when I can have a complaint.
So is it a particularly English thing? You go all over the world, luckily, with your job. My God, I'm so jealous. Obviously, everywhere in the world has the start of the cricket season, but I don't think there's anywhere, unless you can prove me otherwise, where there is all of this kind of freezing conditions, whatever else. Is it particular to England? Do you see it anywhere else?
I've been very cold at cricket matches before. I think if you talk to anyone who plays for Tasmania, and any fans who are silly enough to go down to Blunston Arena or Belrive Oval and watch, even in the height of summer, it can be absolutely freezing there. So, you know, and there's been a lot of talk about playing at this time of year, and obviously the Kookaburra and everything as well. And then I was thinking, you know what? It does rain in Australia. If you watched a test match in Sydney over the last 5 years, you'll see it rains an awful lot. So the Kookaburra does get wet when they play with it in Australia as well. I was just reminded of that. I was thinking, gosh, we've all been talking as if it's always hot and dry everywhere in Australia all the time. No, it's not. But you don't see, as I have, all the players wearing snoods and hand warmers probably as much, I would say.
Yeah, it's funny because I was just having to stray onto the Aussie rules at the weekend. And I think they were playing in Adelaide, and that looked pretty sort of English midwinter conditions up there. The crowd are all wrapped up, and the players seem to be, it's not the usual scenes from the Adelaide Oval that I'm used to.
Yeah, but look, it snows in Australia. It's a very, very big country, and it does have winter. And so, yes, there are parts of it that are very cold, very wet, and all of that as well. You probably just don't see as much cricket being played at the times when it is that cold.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Kookaburra ball. Let's talk about this. So the ECB, in their wisdom, and the ECB always have these fantastic ideas of new balls, new tournaments, new formats. But let's just talk about the Kookaburra ball to start off with. So the idea being, for those that aren't up to speed with this, is that the counties are using Kookaburra balls for the first couple of games of this season, and there'll be other slots later on where they'll be using it. The idea, or the wisdom, being that this will help players that are destined for the Ashes, not this winter, next winter, to be used to playing with a Kookaburra ball. How do you think this experiment has gone from what we've seen so far?
Look, like everything, I think there's a lot of nuance to it, and it's not just about winning the Ashes either. I mean, you have to remember that the Kookaburra is played with around the world. So if anyone has England aspirations, they're going to have to either bat against the Kookaburra ball or bowl with it. Whether they go to Caribbean, whether they go to New Zealand, whether they go to South Africa. So probably, I know that the Ashes are special, but there's a little bit something wider in there, encouraging spinners to get more time, because usually they ain't getting anywhere near a bowl this time of year in particular, and to sort of find out if bowlers have any pace about them as well, because we all know, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory way, but a medium pacer with a Duke's ball in April is normally going to just have to put it there or thereabouts, and they're a danger, right? That's how it is, and that's, part of the attraction, I guess, in county cricket. And you always want to have the balance with bat and ball. I think people have maybe, it's just too easy and too soon to just go, rubbish idea, ball's rubbish, all of that. I think there are perhaps some ways in which this could be done better. And it's probably just not a simple solution. So whether it works having it at this time of year, when it is much more likely to be wet, and the Kookaburra being wet is where the problem comes in. It swells, it gets soft really quickly, and there hasn't been much in it for the bowlers. Interestingly, at Warwickshire, they had a specialist come in to teach them how to maintain the ball, which kind of blew my mind, because you sort of assume that everybody who plays cricket professionally knows how to do it. But of course, a lot of the players haven't had to do that before. That was interesting to me. But then to take that a little bit further, I wonder how much overall cohesion there has been with the ECB. Instead of just going, here's your Kookaburra, go off and play with it, has there actually been more thought put into everything else around it? By that, I also include the preparation of the pitches. So in Australia, after the 2015 Trent Bridge Ashes Test, which I'm sure you remember very well.
Now, remind me. What happened there?
There was a very, very much a ball swinging about, and Australia were absolutely blown out of the water. And afterwards, Ricky Ponting led the charge. He said that they needed to introduce a Duke's ball to the Sheffield Shield in Australia, because Australian batters did not know how to bat against a swinging ball in England. So they introduced a Duke's round in Australia. What happened the first couple of times they tried it, but similar things that happened here, ball went soft, Australia, abrasive grounds, all that sort of thing. So it took them a few goes to actually work out, right, well, there's probably not much point in playing a round of the Sheffield Shield in Perth. In the height of summer, because what are you replicating there? You ain't going to get it doing anything. So they also talked to the ground staff. The ground staff also worked out, we've got to prepare a pitch specifically for the Duke's round, and we need to leave more grass on it. We might need to, the outfield might need to be, you know, we'll have to look at when we do it so that the outfield's at a certain stage, but particularly, obviously, the pitch, because you can't do too much to change an outfield. But that it took them a while to do it. And then it became slowly became a more useful experiment. What part of the season you do it in, where you do it, and the pitches. Now here, any of the ground staff who managed to get a pitch in a condition to play in these first two rounds probably deserves a medal, because it has been really, really difficult after such a wet lead into the season. So it's ideally, you don't want them in that situation where they're just preparing whatever they can and hope that they can actually get a match on. I mean, we've got one ground at Worcestershire, Blimmin' underwater. So yeah. You can't say to, hey, do you mind at Worcester preparing this kind of pitch this week? Unless you're preparing one for water polo. So look, that's one thing certainly that I've been thinking about, that there's not much point in just going, here, play with the Kookaburra. What communication is there with the grounds, with the counties and what they're doing? A mitigating factor, I was at Warwickshire, and it's one thing to just look at scorecards, but at Warwickshire, I was told the short boundary was 50 yards, but I don't believe it. I reckon it was more like 40.
Yeah,
I saw the pictures. Really, really short boundary. So if you have that in combination with a ball people aren't used to, with a pitch that's pretty soft, with a run-up that's really heavy, God, the bowlers are really up against it anyway, right? So how much are you going to learn playing at this time of year with a boundary that's that short? Sorry, I'm talking a lot, aren't I?
But I've been thinking
about all of this. But then you look at someone like Sam Cook in the first round. It'd be interesting to hear kind of what he took away from it. And, you know, if he's made a few people now look in his direction, because the scouts have been out and about watching these first couple of rounds and just seeing who does what. So you just look at it. There's an existential question in there about what is the county championship for? Is it a first-class competition that deserves to be untouched, left to be the best competition that it can be? Or is it a platform to provide England players? Do those two things have to be mutually exclusive? Ideally, no. And that's probably where there's the tension around. You talk about complaining. People complain about things when they care about it. And a massive difference in Australia, I made this sort of joke with a point, if you like, when I was on commentary. In Australia, if they genuinely believed that it would help them win the Ashes in England if all the players wore tutus and fielded with one hand tied behind their backs, honestly, you'd have a one-arm tutu round of the Sheffield Shield like that, and people wouldn't really care. Players wouldn't like it, but you wouldn't have club members caring. It's not the New South Wales club. It's a bit more sort of, I don't know, perfunctory when it comes to that. Certainly pragmatic. Choose the right P word. But it's a bit more pragmatic than that, I think, in Australia. So they've played with orange balls, with white balls, with pink balls, Duke's balls, all with a view of how can we have better test players. And, you know, it just doesn't cause nearly as much of a fuss as it does here. There's one more point I'll make about the Duke's ball or the Kookaburra ball. I think you look at someone like a Chris Rushworth, what's he going to get out of bowling with a Kookaburra ball at this stage of his career? And a lot of other bowlers out there who play first-class cricket, because it's a valuable and incredibly impressive feat in its own right to have a first-class career. They're going to be walking away from this going, can't wait to get the Dukes back. But those players who might be there or thereabouts for England, do they walk away from this round and think, do you know what? When the ball's not doing anything, when it's flat, when it's not moving about, I might need to add a few more things to my armory, whether it's extra pace, whether it's control and accuracy, being able to put it on a dime, whether it's variations, what is it, whether it's fielding, whatever it is. If young bowlers in particular are walking away thinking about all of those things, then there might have been some benefit for it for them. It might be even more of a benefit for 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds to be playing with the red kookaburra. And that's probably where I'd be looking. Rather than Chris Rushworth bowling with the kookaburra, might there be more benefit to England in the long run if it's introduced at all the academies and all the age group areas? Then they're coming in and they're learning from a young age the difference between the two and how to bowl. There might be some benefit in that in the long term, and that's probably where you have to look. So that's I know I've brought in an awful lot of things there, but I mean I have been thinking about it a lot. There are probably things to be had or gained from having some kookaburra bowled with or kookaburra involvement in the county championship, if it's done the right way, at the right time of the year, in the right conditions, the right pitches, and also if it's introduced to age cricket as well.
Yeah, I like that point. That's really good. Just at the other end of that same spectrum, though, one of the things that's been noticed or commented about in the county championship so far, if we're doing all of this with the kookaburra to blood players, international players, with the Ashes as being the target, a lot of the England regulars are missing so far, from particularly amongst the bowlers in the county championship so far. We've seen a few of the batters out there, but surely if this is all being designed around finding and improving England test players, they should be taking part in the experiment.
Absolutely, that's part of it. I mean you probably would find the ideal in Australia is having the test players available for the pink ball round, for example, that they always have a pink ball round because they have a pink ball test in Australia. So yes, you do. You want your test players to be doing it. Again, that just all comes into like a cohesion. And it's different here because the counties all sort of operate in their own way, in their own little world. Whereas in Australia, there's much more power and involvement when it comes to Cricket Australia and the states and the cohesion. There are fewer states as well to deal with. So that kind of just highlights my point as well about, okay, when are you doing it? But it's also about potentials. There might be players who are playing in these two rounds who might be in Australia in 8 months' time. Well, a lot of things can happen in 18 months. So a bit over 18 months. So we'll see. But, yep, that's all part of it. It kind of just emphasises the point in having a really good look at, if you're going to do it in the way that gives you the best possible result.
And despite all of the complaints and noises from members and supporters and all that, and I really like your turn of phrase that you use there, you only complain if you care. But despite all of this, despite the growing spectre of franchise cricket, of white ball cricket, of T20, even 100, county championship cricket here still remains one of the crown jewels. I mean, so much so, I look around the overseas players that are over here, and again, this year, there's a fantastic contingent of top-name players that are itching to play red ball cricket. We've got, obviously, Nathan Lyon up at Lancashire, Dean Elgar's at Essex, Jason Holder has appeared as well. It still holds that allure for the top guys.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was just talking to Scott Boland at Warwickshire. Obviously, he's come over for Durham. And he was really excited. His family's coming over. Yeah, he's really looking forward to taking them around Durham, his kids, and the opportunity to be here to play county championship, but also for him, white ball cricket as well, the various formats that are on offer for him. And he was just genuinely really excited. You could see that. And it is. watching, you know, Kumar Roach and watching some of the Indian players. Look at Karan Nair at the moment. Why wouldn't you? You've got a really good opportunity being in the Northern Hemisphere when there's, in these months, when there isn't domestic cricket being played in the South. I'd be really encouraging any players to come over and get some good solid, you know, overs and runs and time in the middle. And beyond that, you do have the specialness of the crowd support and the fans. I met this wonderful lady from Durham who had come down and was sitting there in the freezing cold. She goes to so many of their matches, gets on the drive every weekend that she can. And that's a very special part of county cricket. And I think you talk to players who come over here and have spent time over here, that's a massive part of what they love about as well. You feel you're part of something.
And it even drip feeds lower down than that. So, you know, I'm here in Essex, and club cricket in Essex now is going at a different level. So in the Premier League, Jordan Silk is going to be playing for Brentwood, just down the road here. JJ Smuts has been here. We've got Grant Rollerton, who was shining for South Africa last year in the SA20. He's turning up at Billericay Cricket Club. So, you know, it's all the way down. And if people sort of bitch and moan about cricket, just get along. It's out there. You've just got to, it's on a plate. Just go and take it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate that it does mean sort of shivering a bit, but it is great to have it back over here. I always look forward to coming over here at the start of the season.
So you hear all seven of them?
Yes. I'm going to the T20 World Cup in the Caribbean and the US in June. That's pretty exciting. I'm looking forward to that, going to a couple of places I haven't been to before. So that's going to be good fun. But yeah, so I'm around. Going to the Wisden dinner tonight. That's at Lord's. So I haven't been back at Lord's. The great thing about cricket is the people, and I'm very fortunate that I know lots of people around the world and feel like I can land in a country and I've got friends immediately on hand. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing a lot of my colleagues in the media at the Wisden dinner. So it's also been fantastic going around. I love doing the county championship commentary. It's really, really enjoyable, just having that time to sort of watch a lot of cricket and talk about it and, you know, have a bit of a laugh with my co-commentators as well. So, yeah, after that, I'll be back. I don't know what I'm doing. I never know what I'm doing besides, you know, the next thing. But the plan, yeah, is to sort of be in this part of the world until it comes time to be like a migratory bird and head south for the winter.
Fantastic. I'm just looking for my invitation to the Wisden dinner tonight, so it must be buried under all the other mail I get. But listen,
I haven't been to one since before the pandemic. 2019 was the last time, because I haven't been over here early enough in the last two summers. And, of course, I wasn't here for a couple of years. So it's extra special. And I do contribute to the Almanac every year. So I feel I've worked for that one.
Well, listen, if you're ever down at Chelmsford commentating on Essex, give me a shout and I'll be more than happy to bring you a hot chocolate and a bobbly hat and some Essex-branded hand warmers just to keep you going. It'll be fantastic to have you along. Really, really enjoyed chatting and some really interesting points that you've made. So I really do appreciate you giving me the time and being for such a special guest on 98 No Doubt.
Thanks so much for having me.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
I'm John Charby, inviting you to join me here on Phoenix FM on Saturday afternoons for Phoenix Sport. The top local, national and international sports stories, plus live scores, results, reports, interviews, quiz questions and my sporting anniversaries. And lots of great music too. That's Phoenix Sport, every Saturday from 3 till 6pm here on Phoenix 98 FM.
Tune into the Sunday Sessions on Phoenix FM every Sunday morning, 10 till 12, with me, Kevlar. I'll be bringing you tracks from local artists. Most of those tracks are recorded down at our open mic, which takes place every Monday at 8pm at the Essex Arms in Brentwood, right next door to Brentwood Station. Come along and just watch, or if you're a singer or songwriter, come along and sing us a song.
Sing, sing, sing.
It's me, Michelle Ward. A prawn cocktail.
I love
a prawn cocktail. I'm always rambling. What's the mayor's chain called?
Chain.
Chain. In fact, I never stopped talking. And I rubbed, basically, all of the skin off the inside of my thigh. You can answer my question of the day.
Michelle.
I think men go through the menopause from about the ages of 18 to 65. And after that, they die. Fantastic guests and super music. What am I lacking in the diet? Humour, really?
Yes.
Weekdays 10 till 1.
98. 98. FM. This is Phoenix 98 FM.
Now, at the top of the show, I mentioned the sad news of the death of deadly Derek Underwood. Well, just while I've been perusing my socials, I've just found out that former England test batter Raymond Subba-Rowe has died at the age of 92. Another great name has passed. Subba-Rowe, who won the first of his 13 caps, his 13 England caps in 1958, played domestically for Cambridge University, Surrey and Northamptonshire. And after retiring from playing in 1961, he worked as a cricket administrator and match referee. There are great tributes coming in on X and other social media. So if you want to have a look at a great man, another great man who has sadly left us, then take a look. But Raymond Subba-Rowe has died today at the age of 92.
This is Phoenix 98 FM.
Now, thanks to Mel Farrell for that excellent interview. If you want to catch up with it again, head to the 98 Out podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want the video version, that is now available on YouTube. Now, she mentioned in that chat that she was on her way to the Wisden Dinner, which was on Tuesday night. And it was the launch of this year's Wisden Cricketers Almanac. And if you've got a copy and haven't posted a picture on social media, I suggest you do, because just about everyone else in the world has done so. Now, just coming out from that dinner, there were some awards given. England all-rounder Nat Siver-Brunt and Australia captain Pat Cummings have been named as the leading cricketers in the world by Wisden. I tried not to say that, but like Jeremy Clarkson, but I think I got away with it. Siver-Brunt becomes the first English woman to be given the honour, while Cummins led his side to the World Test Championship and the 50-over World Cup and sort of nicked the Ashes, I suppose. England's Harry Brook and Mark Wood are among the five cricketers of the year. They are joined by Australian trio Usman Khawaja, Mitchell Stark and Ashley Gardner. Another Australian batter, Travis Head, wins the Wisden Trophy for Test Performance of the Year following his 163 of 174 balls in the Test Championship final victory over India at the Oval in June. Now, there's news as well today from the world of women's cricket. The ECB has announced that eight counties will host professional women's teams as part of a major restructure of the domestic game from 2025. Durham, Essex, Hampshire, Lancashire, Nottinghamshire, Somerset, Surrey and Warwickshire have all been awarded Tier 1 status. Glamorgan and Yorkshire join them in 2027 as part of an expansion. And the ECB also intends to add a further two teams in 2029, although it hasn't said who they will be. In 2025, the eight selected counties will replace the regions that have competed in the Charlotte Edwards Cup and the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy in recent years. The plan will see a creation of a three-tiered domestic competition structure, which the ECB said could lead to an 80% increase in professional women's cricket players in England and Wales by 2029. There will be £8 million of new funding every year for the women's domestic game by 2027, taking annual investment to about £19 million. Glamorgan and Yorkshire will receive additional funding from 2025 to run their own Tier 1 standard talent pathways in preparation for joining the top tier in 2027. However, Yorkshire say they are surprised and disappointed not to be among the eight counties that will host professionals women's cricket from 2025. Leicestershire, meanwhile, say they are crestfallen to have missed out altogether. And Kent, despite their women's performance centre being based in Beckenham, also missed out, with the club's chairman, Simon Phillip, describing the decision as difficult to swallow. I've got a certain amount of sympathy, but also I think I would be interested to know the reactions of those counties that don't have those Tier 1 women's franchises and Tier 1 teams awarded, and also they don't have any 100 franchises or anything else like that. They are just left to get by on traditional red and white ball cricket. I'd be interested to hear everyone's thoughts on that.
98 FM. This is Phoenix 98 FM.
All right, round up of the counties. We've had round two completed this week. Nine matches, nine draws. A combination of Kent's 18-year-old debutant Jaden Henley, that's the nephew of Joe, not the son, as a lot of people seem to be saying, but a combination of him and bad weather scuppered Essex's hopes of recording back-to-back county championship wins. The all-rounder joined forces with Uncle Joe in a sixth wicket stand that took 16 overs and contributed 51 runs after Kent had been on the ropes at 65 for 5. Jaden Stanley stood firm for 128 balls on a rain-interrupted final day at Chelmsford, finishing on 41 not out in Kent's 164 for 7. Jamie Porter again in the wickets, taking a 4 for 20. Essex declared for a second time in the match on their overnight 257 for 4, with Jordan Cox unbeaten on 116 after his fireworks of the previous evening. And that set Kent at 375 to win, initially from 76 overs, then 64 after the morning session was abandoned following another downpour. The draw leaves means Essex have 15 points, Kent have 12. Surrey fell short in an exciting fourth-day run chase against Somerset as their County Championship Division 1 game ended in a draw. Chasing 209 in 19 overs, Dan Lawrence and Jamie Smith hit 32 off the 7th and 8th overs to take their stand up to 90 and set up the prospect of a first win of the season for the champions. But Surrey lost 5 wickets in the next 5 overs to stop their charge, and they settled for a draw at the Oval. Surrey 14 points and Somerset 11. Matthew Potts scored his maiden first-class century to help Durham earn a draw on their return to the County Championship Division 1 against Warwickshire at Edgbaston. Warwickshire began the final day scenting a victory as their newly promoted opponents, following on, resumed on 12 for 2 and still 169 behind. But stubborn batting led by night watchman Potts, who ended on 149 right out, saw Durham close on 293 for 6, and it earned them a draw after their first match back in the top tier against Hampshire was abandoned without a ball being bowled last week. A draw looked a long way off when the visitors conceded 698 for 3 in the first innings, but their response of 517 was the third highest score by a team which then had to follow on. At the end of the day, Warwickshire 15 points and Durham 11 points. Nick Gubbins batted out the final day as Hampshire secured a draw in their county championship match against Lancashire at the Utilita Bowl, whatever it's called this week. Gubbins added an unbeaten 69 to his first innings 50 in a 4.5-hour vigil to end any chance of a Hampshire collapse. And as a result, with James Vince and Tom Prest equally stubborn in their resistance as the hosts finished on 179 for 4. Lancashire 13 points, Hampshire 12. Worcestershire were denied the possibility of a first win back in the championship as rain prevented a play against Nottinghamshire. The home side were left to begin the final day on 157 for 7 at Trent Bridge, 193 ahead with 3 wickets left. Lyndon James and Leon Paterson-White were not out on 7 and 1 respectively. but the bad weather meant that no play was possible before lunch, and the umpires called the game off at 2:30. Notts 14 points, Worcester 13 points. Lewis Reese and Brooke Guest steered Derbyshire to a draw at Glamorgan on a rain-affected final day in Cardiff. Set an improbable 401 to win, Derbyshire were reduced to 79 for 3, but making the most of a docile pitch, Reese hit an unbeaten 91 and Guest made 72 not out in an unbroken stand of 146 as the visitors closed on 225 for 3. Glamorgan 11 points and Derbyshire 11 points each. So at the end of round two, the tables are Essex remain top with 35 points, but remember they have got a possible points deduction hanging over them, one for the ongoing allegations of historical racism, but also there was an incident with Feroz Kushi and the bat last week. But anyway, as it stands, they are top with 35 points. Warwickshire are second on 28 points. Worcester are third on 27. Reigning champs Surrey are fifth with 25. And Nottinghamshire prop up the bottom of the table with 18 points. Now, the next round of games starts tomorrow. The weather doesn't look too bad. I think there are scattered showers around, but we should see a decent amount of cricket. Essex are hosting Lancashire. Hampshire are hosting Warwickshire. Kent versus Surrey. Somerset versus Nottinghamshire. Warwickshire versus Durham. And in Division 2, Derbyshire versus Leicestershire. Middlesex versus Yorkshire. Northamptonshire versus Glamorgan. And Sussex versus Gloucestershire.
Go to phoenixfm.com and listen to online guest interviews. Check the events for your area and listen to great radio online.
Galloping towards the top of the hour, remember to stay tuned to Phoenix FM. My good old mate John Chubb follows at 7 with the non-league hour. Then at 8, Gareth is here, Gareth Williams with Bumper to Bumper. And then at 10, Madeline Christie is here with the Night Shift, which is a great, great show. Really good music. If you're up at that time of night and are bored with the telly, just switch on Phoenix and you will get some great stuff with Madeline. Elsewhere around the world of cricket, the IPL continues. And there was one thing that leapt at me this week. It was a great headline. The Butler did it. Josh Butler, of course. He hit 107 not out to lead Rajasthan Royals to a thrilling final ball win in pursuit of 224 against Kolkata Knight Riders. England's white ball captain struggled for his touch early on, but burst into life when the seventh wicket fell. He faced every ball in the last three overs and scored the single needed from the last ball to seal a two-wicket win. The Royals' chase was the joint highest in the IPL and puts Butler's Royals top of the table. Speaking of records, Sunrisers Hyderabad broke the record for the highest IPL total for the second time this season by posting an incredible 287 for 3 against Royal Challengers Bengaluru. Travis Head hit 102 from 41 balls as Sunrisers beat the 277 for 3 they made against Mumbai Indians last month. It was the second highest score in a men's T20 and the highest in a franchise tournament. The match ended as the highest scoring T20 with RCB losing by just 25 runs. And finally, I just picked up a story. The new series of Clarkson's Farm is about to be released on Amazon Prime. And Jeremy Clarkson has been talking about the new series. And there's one bit that jumped out at me, which I thought I'd just share with you guys. He's found a nice little earner for his farm. He's going to sell wood from its trees to make cricket bats. Clarkson has discovered the 1,000-acre Diddley Squat Farm is perfect for growing the type of willow used, and each bat willow tree can sell for hundreds of pounds. Clarkson admitted he actively hated cricket when he was at school, but he declared, "I've worked out to get my own back on these people, and I'm going to take all their money." So we shall see. And I wonder what the quality of those bats are and whether the traditional bat makers are quaking in at their boots. But someone might want to remind Clarkson about the rules and regulations. And particularly in Feroz Kusi's case, the dimensions, weight, etc., etc. Right now, before I go, and remember to download the show later on this evening, it will be available on the phoenixfm.com website. Head to the podcast and subscribe. It's free and available wherever you get your podcasts, and of course YouTube as well. I've started to posting the videos of all of the interviews on there. But at the top of the show, I did say about a bit of music that I played. It was by a band called Mountain. It was proper prog rock from the 70s. Nantucket Sleigh Ride, brackets to Owen Coffin. Now, you've got to be a certain age, but Weekend World used a portion of that track for their theme tune to that song. And if you do remember Sunday lunchtimes with, first of all, Peter Jay and then Brian Walden, back in those days with heavyweight political interviews, I think it was probably the first to do that before we had the likes of Laura Koonsberg and Sophie Ridge and all the rest of them. Anyway, that's what it was. Well done if you got it. And make sure you tune in again next week for more 1908. John Chubb is here, ready to go. And to play you out is that bit of music, the theme tune to Weekend World.